people who have really suffered here are the civilians.
They are arbitrary because they're being used.
No, because they're lived and used.
They're certainly not organic.
The fact is that Islamophobia is rampant in our society.
Well, I think we should all be treated equally.
And
I don't want to poke fun at Jews.
No, truth and lies cannot be equated.
And I just want Muslims to be treated the same as everyone else in this society.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome to this special edition of Pressing Questions. In today's show, I'll be interviewing the editor of Five Pillars, Roshan Muhammad Saleh, on the release of his new book, The Confessions of a Muslim Journalist. Roshan Muhammad Saleh is a veteran journalist who's been in the industry for 18 years, working both within the mainstream media and the Muslim media. So without any further delay, Roshan, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam.
Let me begin by asking you, what inspired you to write this book?
Well, I think I've got an interesting job. And when I go to dinner parties, I don't go to many dinner parties, but when I do, I'm the one with the interesting job. You know, everyone else is, I work in IT, end of conversation kind of thing. Whereas I've been around the world, interviewed lots of interesting people, whether that be heads of state or criminals or jihadis, whatever. Lots of people that I've interviewed and ended up dead or in prison, etc., etc. So I just have a lot of interesting stories to tell. So I thought, let's put it all down in a book in my kind of 18-year varied journalism career. I also thought that there weren't many good books out there specifically about journalism, which were honest, which actually gave the reader an insight into what a journalist does and what motivates him, the restrictions in which a journalist works, the kind of value systems of different media organizations. Some of them have no values whatsoever. So journalists do come, and the whole profession of journalism does come in for a bit of criticism in the book. And finally, I would say that there aren't many books out there by British Muslims that are readable. A lot of them are academic, or the best books about British Islam in Britain have actually been written by non-Muslims. So I think it's about time we started telling our own stories.
And obviously you've entitled the book Confessions of a Muslim Journalist. Now, without giving away any major spoilers, what kind of secrets do you reveal in this book?
Well, it's not a kiss and... It's a bit of a tabloid kind of title, I admit. But it's not a kiss and tell book like, you know, The Sun or something like that. But there are several kind of things that I'm going to reveal in the book that people wouldn't have heard of. But I think generally, without getting into too much detail and spoiling it, I think generally what I want to get across in the book is that journalists are basically lying to the public in the sense that they say, oh, we're fair, we're balanced, we're impartial, we're telling the truth, we are not taking sides, etc., etc. That's all rubbish. It's all complete rubbish. All journalism is propaganda to one extent or another. And the only difference between different prominent journalistic outlets is the sophistication of that propaganda. So that's the main kind of secret that I'm trying to get across, that journalism and journalists isn't exactly what you think it is.
So let me just press on that point. So obviously you've just said that, you know, majority if not all media outlets are a form of propaganda, and the only difference between them is the level of sophistication. So again, without giving away any major spoilers, what kind of institutions and organisations do you talk about?
Well, obviously I talk about my time at in the mainstream media. I used to work for London Weekend Television, which made programmes for ITV, Channel 4, Discovery Channel, etc., etc. Then I moved on to Al Jazeera. There's a big section in the book about Al Jazeera. And I think it's probably the most honest account of what it's like to work for Al Jazeera that you'll read anywhere. In terms of living in Doha, I used to live right next to a massive US airbase. Never wrote a word about that. I used to live next to lots of construction sites where slave laborers were working 24/7 in the searing heat. Never wrote a word about that because you don't urinate on your own doorstep ultimately. There are other stuff. Obviously I'll tell the inside story of how Press TV got kicked off the Sky platform, for example. Also I tell the story of how David Cameron, when he was being interviewed shortly before becoming Prime Minister, he was asked while he was checking his microphone sound who is the leader of Hamas, and he said Hassan Nasrallah. So obviously at the time he was trying to boost his foreign policy credentials. Now again, that never aired because the Conservative Party came to an agreement with the channel that I was working for that it wouldn't be aired. But you know, this is the kind of thing that, you know, what's more interesting about what you see on screen is what you don't see on screen.
The opening chapter, you state that you're an authority on journalism, which kind of may lead one to believe that you may think that there are journalists out there today, Muslim and non-Muslim, who lack qualifications and real-life experience on the job but are still promoted as some form of authorities?
Well, I'm not sure if I use those words, I am an authority on journalism. But yeah, I take your point. Without blowing my trumpet too much, I mean, I have been a journalist for 18 years. And I think, I mean, one of the things that I'm offended by, and I'll say this frankly, is everyone thinks they're journalists nowadays. Because they can start a blog or use an iPhone. But ultimately, these are people without training, without experience, without qualifications. But journalism is a trade like any other, and it needs to be respected as a trade. And I don't feel it is. Now, obviously, if you want to get sick, sorry, if you want to get healed from being sick, you go to a doctor and, you know, that person is qualified, trained, has experience. But I don't think people think of journalism in the same kind of context. And I want people to view it as a trade. And proper journalists who do a proper job, they need training and experience. And I think I've got that.
Okay. There are sections within your book where I personally sensed, after reading it, a huge level of frustration at the mainstream media, especially during your time at the regional press and LWT and then Granada, where you also worked alongside Mehdi Hassan for a short period. Is this frustration as a result of your inability to progress within the mainstream?
What a nasty question. No, no. I'm sure if I'd done my years, I was about 5 years in the mainstream. Yeah. I'm sure if I'd done my time and I would have slid up that greasy pole. But the mainstream is not for the likes of me and you, ultimately, because they ultimately represent the state's interests. They do stories which, I mean, it's institutionally Islamophobic to a large extent. And no matter how much you try, how many tokenistic brown faces they get in, you know, to prove that they're not Islamophobic, that's what they are. And you can only make kind of ripples of, in terms of doing good stories that reach wide audiences, you know, sometimes it can be benefit to engage with the mainstream. But generally, I think that, we aren't going to make much of a difference. And I think we need to build our own institutions. And that's what I've tried to do with Five Pillars with you.
Do you think had you stuck at it, you could have progressed on a compromised way?
Yes, I'm sure I would have been able to do some good work. And that good work would have reached a lot more people than perhaps some of the work that I've done now through, you know, other places I've chosen to work at. But ultimately, working in the alternative media is a career choice for me and a personal choice. Because, I mean, I use the phrase, people might be offended by this, but I don't want to be the white man's monkey. You know, that's what I say in the book, ultimately. I want to be in control. I want to have, I want to do work which corresponds with my values. And ultimately, if I work in the mainstream, they have their own values. And ultimately, I'm just going to end up tearing my hair out, being very frustrated.
Which kindly leads me to the next question. You speak about Press TV similar to how Francis Fukuyama speaks about democracy. You're clearly very happy there. But hasn't Iran's recent involvement in the war in Syria affected you in any way?
Yeah, look, I mean, I do kind of slag off a lot of my workplaces, not in a kind of nasty way, but I think in a truthful way. But I do say bad things. Perhaps I haven't said as many bad things about Press TV. But generally, I have been happy. I'm not happy, ecstatic every single day because I'm not that kind of person. But generally, I've been there about 9 years now, and it's allowed me to chronicle British Muslims, like I have done in previous workplaces, the story of British Muslims. It's allowed me to travel all over the world. Frankly, as a young man, I was inspired by the values of the Iranian Revolution, anti-imperialistic values, pro-Palestine, pro-Islam, anti-West. That's kind of who I am as a person. So I think it's very rare for someone to have the opportunity to actually work at a workplace where you actually agree with most of the values. Most people don't actually do that. I'm not saying that everything that has come on Press TV I agree with, and everything that Iran does I agree with, but generally I would say 80% I'm kind of in step with it, and that's probably as much as you're going to get at any workplace. Otherwise, you're going to be signing off on the dole. You know, if you insist on 100% coherence between your values and the place that pays your salary, then you're going to end up on the dole. Syria, yes.
Yeah, that's what I'm wanting to get at. Yeah,
it's definitely the most challenging subject, and I talk about it in depth in the book. I give it quite a lot, and I would encourage people to read that. And I think it's quite difficult to talk about Syria in simple sound bites. And that's why I felt more comfortable talking about it in the book, because I think people will get a sense of who I am as a person. And because they know where I'm coming from, my hinterland as a person, they'll perhaps understand my views on Syria more. Now, my views on Syria are probably out of step with most British Muslims and perhaps most Muslims around the world. But they are sincerely held views. And I think Press TV's Syria policy, where it's effectively backed the Assad government, has polarized its audience. It used to be very popular with Muslims all over the world prior to that. Since Syria came about, I think it has lost a lot of viewers. On the other hand, it's gained some other viewers. But I think it reflects the polarization that, you know, this topic has engendered. And I think the same would be true to say of other TV stations like Al Jazeera, which has taken a different policy to Press TV on Syria. Has it troubled me personally? Yes, of course it has. Obviously, you know, any country which is undergoing slaughter on the level or the insane levels that Syria has undergone. You know, I've been to Syria myself. I know that region quite well. And I just find it heartbreaking. And I just wish the war would end. But I think my idea of, you know, who caused the war, why it sustained itself, and how it can finish will probably be at odds with what most British Muslims think. But they can read the book and judge me on that. I'm not trying to hide what I think or who I am. And they can judge me for the better or the worse. But ultimately, I encourage them to read the book because then they'll get a full picture of what I believe rather than snippets from different sound bites here and there.
And on the point of Iran, you mentioned five things in the book, towards the end of the book, which kind of define who you are. And alongside being Muslim, you mentioned Iran. Why Iran?
I'm fascinated by Iran. Yeah, I have been. I mean, I've been to Iran several times, and I am fascinated by the country. And I encourage people, you know, who might not agree with. I know one of our mutual friends went there recently, who is against Iran's foreign policy in particular. And I think I would respect that mutual friend's views more now, even if his views are still critical of Iran, just because he's been there. And I think most people that criticize Iran do so from a position of ignorance. And that's what I object to, really, because I think, obviously, I've been deeply involved with Iranian politics for a long time now. I told you how I was inspired by the Iranian Revolution long before I joined Press TV, etc., etc. I've been to Iran several times. I have an understanding of their geopolitical position and the way they think. And I think before you judge Iran or any country, you need to know about that. I do like Iran. I know any nation state is going to do good things and bad things, and I'm sure Iran will have a similar kind of history, will kind of judge Iran negatively and positively on different aspects of what it's done. But I do love Iran as a country. Its landscape. Yeah, I love Turkey as well.
But you love it enough to, you know, be one of five things to define you as a human being?
I think at the age, a grand old age of 43 now, I think it has been one of the five things that's defined my life in terms of my values and my politics. And there's a lot in the book. And I think a lot of people may think that I'm over-egging it a little bit and that I'm being an Iranian propagandist, etc.
Well, are you? Are you an Iranian propagandist?
To a certain extent, I am, I suppose, I'm not going to hide away from that. To a certain extent, I mean, look, I'm not a propagandist to the extent that I will sit here and tell you that everything Iran has ever done is correct. But I think broadly, given its geopolitical position and the policy decisions it's taken, I'm down with it, most of it. The book, but people will judge me on that, and I'm ready to take that judgment.
Okay. And obviously, again, my next question kind of interlinks with the whole topic of Iran and Syria. Sectarianism is something you're very passionately against. Yet, some could argue, after reading your book, I would argue, that you seem to disproportionately blame Sunnis for it. Why is this?
Well, I do think sectarianism is a curse. I mean, ultimately, I think the question of who is and who isn't a Muslim has been decided long ago by greater minds than ours. And it's not as if Sunnis and or Shias have suddenly got new beliefs in the 20th century or the 21st century. So I think who is and who isn't a Muslim has already been decided, and we should basically accept that. However, when it comes to the, you know, am I blaming Sunnis more? Well, I think there are more Sunnis around, for a start. You know, 80% or more than that of Muslims are Sunnis. So I think it's probably natural that most of the good and bad things from Islam will probably come from Sunnis because there's more Sunnis around. So that's one thing I would say. From my own personal experience, I'm slightly concerned that sectarianism is perhaps more mainstream amongst Sunnis than it is amongst Shias.
How have you come to that decision?
Well, I think, without naming names, I don't want to name names because I don't want to be too...
Now, let's not name names. Yeah, we want to hear from people's lawyers.
Yeah, no, exactly. But also, there are good people out there that will disagree with what I'm saying, and I don't want to target them as well. I would say that the prevalence of takfir is more mainstream amongst the Sunni community in terms of prominent figures that we all accept as being our leaders and our spokespeople, etc. I think it's more prominent amongst them, and they let their followers get away with it more than the Shias do. I think the sectarians amongst the Shias, and there are definite sectarians amongst the Shias, crazy ones, I think they're more on the margins. However, I think there has been, over the last few years, a few Shia figures who are becoming equally as sectarian, and that's equally as worrying. And I think the basic deal is if we want to move forward as a community, because ultimately if we're divided, they're going to pick us off, right? And we don't have to hug each other and love each other or agree with everything each other does. But ultimately, as a community, if we're divided and if we're attacking each other, and we're at each other's throats, they're going to pick us off one by one. Our real enemy, the Zionists, the imperialists, the pro-prevent people, they're going to pick us off one by one. Ultimately, I think a deal has to be done, and that is that Shias have got to stop cursing the Sahaba. Whether it's in secret or open, they've got to stop cursing the Sahaba. Because if there's one thing that kind of winds Sunnis up more than anything, it's that. And on the other hand, I think Sunnis, and I'm generalizing here, of course, need to stop making blanket takfir of others.
But wouldn't their takfir be based on cursing the Sahaba?
Well, we can go around. It's a circular argument, isn't it? And we can go around. And I think ultimately, perhaps it is... I think we can argue who's to blame more. And perhaps there's no point trying to make that argument because you can come up with good points and I can come up with good points. But I think ultimately, if we want to move forward and look at solutions here, if we want to do that, then I think that is the basic deal. Shias, stop cursing. Sunnis, stop making takfir.
Do you see yourself as a Sunni defender of the Shia? Just out of curiosity, I mean...
Look, I'm a Sunni Muslim. In my book, I talk about that. I'm a Sunni Muslim, always have been. I have no interest in converting to any other sect because ultimately, I don't believe in things like the imamate, for example. So it becomes a Shia, you have to believe in the imamate, right? You know, so... and I'm not an expert, I'm not a theologian. I have obviously a very good understanding of Islam, but I'm not a theologian. So I don't know enough about Sunni theology or Shia theology to, you know, pick holes in this or that. But I'm a Sunni Muslim, culturally, theologically, that is what I believe in. But I also believe the Shias and Sufis, whatever, are Muslims. You know, and there are certain groups that are outside the fold, obviously, like the Druze, like, you know, certain Ismailis, etc. You know, and we all accept that, the Ahmadis, for example. But the general consensus of the vast majority of Shia and Sunni scholars is that, you know, the vast majority of Shias, if not Ashari Shias, and Sunnis, they're Muslims. And that's as far as I would go, but I don't want to really be seen as, you know, a Sunni defender of the Shia. But at the same time, some people think I'm Shia. But if someone calls me a Shia, I'm not offended by it either. It's not like an insult. I don't think, oh no, I'm not a Shia, I'm a Sunni. I don't have Sunni Muslim on my Facebook, you know, profile as a status, you know, I am a Sunni Muslim. No, I'm a Muslim. But if you ask me, if you delve deeper, yes, I'm a Sunni Muslim, and I always will be a Sunni Muslim.
And just before we move on from this point on sectarianism, do you at least appreciate that these deep-rooted theological differences have always existed,
yes,
will always exist, and this kind of utopian unity will perhaps never exist in reality?
Yes, that's why I follow the kind of Yasser Qadhi line on this, and your line as well, that ultimately we're not going to all love each other, we're not going to, you know, sing kumbaya around a fireplace, etc., and hold hands. Some of us will want to, you know, are willing to go to the total unity. Some Sunnis and Shias will marry each other, you know, and have no problem doing that, praying together, etc., stuff like that. But those who don't want to do that, I'm not condemning them, okay? I'm not condemning them. Ultimately, there are some Shias and some Sunnis who will want to do their own thing, and that's absolutely fine by me. But what I do object to is incitement and hatred, which leads to violence on both sides. I think that needs, we have to have a zero tolerance attitude towards that. And ultimately, we've got to grow some balls as well, you know, because often, I know, you know, all the Salafi members of the community, the Shia members, the Sufis, whatever, and the leaders are all fine, but often it's their kind of foot soldiers that seem to be leading them, you know, and I think our leaders need to grow some balls and say, no, zero tolerance. You will not say that. You will not have my endorsement if you say that. But unfortunately, I think they're scared of their flock.
Do you feel events in the Middle East are affecting this?
Absolutely. Yeah. While Syria is burning, this is not going to stop. While Iraq is burning, this is not going to stop. I think it's more driven by politics than theology. And until Syria stops burning, I think it's damage limitation up to that point.
Okay. On to more like UK issues, UK activism, Muslim activism within the UK. You don't seem too hopeful about the future of Muslim activism either. You know, are you just a pessimist who's fed up with everything?
I'm just a half glass empty kind of guy, I think. I just naturally am.
Why is that?
It's just the way I was born, I think. It's just the way I am. And I was having a discussion with quite a prominent imam the other day, and he was like telling me off for it. I am a natural pessimist, all right? And I think that probably comes across in the book, but I'm not hiding who I am.
Why was the imam telling you off?
Well, he was just saying that it's not Islamic to be so pessimistic. And so I think it might be to do with the journalism I've done, the dead bodies that I've seen in the war zones that I've covered, human nature, you know, just the kind of people that I've met in my life, my personal experience. Maybe I've just been unlucky in terms of who I've dealt with in my life. And I think it's unnatural. I mean, it's very unnatural. I mean, there was a point over about 3 or 4 years where I was spending 4 months out of the year in a war zone, you know? And I think that when you see the death and destruction and you smell the stench of death, that leaves a lasting impression on you. When you see a dead body and you couldn't care less, you know, when it becomes everyday occurrence, when you hear a bomb going off, you know, when I was in Iraq, for example, the first few days I was there, I heard a bomb going off and I would jump out of bed and, what's going on? And a few nights later, I wouldn't even get up because it was normal occurrence. So I think when...
Have you become desensitized to
death? I think I have become desensitized to kind of violence and atrocities. And I think that is part of who I am now.
Do you discuss this in the book?
Yeah, I think I do, yeah, to a certain extent. Maybe I should have expanded on it. But I'm a natural pessimist. But getting back to UK issues. Look, I think we have, from when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, there are far more halal meat shops, far more mosques, far more madrasas. We have more of an Islamic identity. There's more Muslims about. But sometimes I think we've never been more divided as a community as we are now. Is there more? There's more quantity, but is there more quality in our dawah, in our interaction with each other, in our interaction with the wider community? So I'm conflicted in terms of Muslim activism, but I think during this divisive time that we're going through, I think the minimum is that we don't incite against each other as groups, and that we do work with each other on areas of mutual concern, like Islamophobia, like Prevent, etc.
I guess I've saved the best till last. Tell me a bit about Five Pillars. What made you launch it, and what does it mean to you?
Well, I think Five Pillars was born out of frustration to a certain extent with the way Muslims were being portrayed in the mainstream, but also the Muslim media. Without slagging people off too much, I did feel that the Muslim media wasn't up to scratch in terms of the quality of its productions and the quality of its journalism. So I just felt I could do a better job. You know, ultimately, being a bit arrogant, I just felt I could do a better job and then got you on board. And I think that's how we feel, that we're trained journalists. So let's do a better job. But also, I think there are a few things to me which are very important. I'm not sure whether you feel the same way about it. I think you do to a certain extent. Mm. independence was a big thing, because I felt that, yeah, I felt that everywhere I'd worked at, there was somebody above me telling me what to write and what not to write. Mm. And I felt that sometimes I was fine with that, sometimes I wasn't. But I wanted to kind of call the shots editorially. And I also wanted to create something which was for the whole community, not just one section of the community. Because I felt that the Muslim media out there was either poor quality or it was sectarian based. It was either bigging at the Salafis or bigging at the Shias or bigging at the Sufis, etc. And I wanted something for the whole community. And I wanted to have a platform where I wouldn't agree with all the content as well. And I would say perhaps at least 30 to 40% of the content on Five Pillars I don't even agree with. And I think you would probably say the same thing.
I'm on about 60,
70%. Yeah. So a lot of the content we don't agree with as the two editors of the site. Mm. You know, so I think that is proof that we are honest people and our vision is for a platform for everybody, it's not just an extension of your ego or my ego. Mm. Now, to a certain extent, the site will reflect our personalities because we are the two editors. Yeah. And I'm sure we do get stuff in there, which is our stuff as well. But at the same time, we are fully committed to publishing stuff which is neutral as far as we're concerned, or also against what we believe.
So based on what you've told me and how you've described Five Pillars and the initial vision that you had, do you feel that we have achieved a platform which is truly inclusive?
Yes and no. I mean, Five Pillars is far from perfect. We need to post more stories, we need to get more staff, we need to grow financially to enable us to do that. But I think in terms of the traction that we get from our readers every day, and we know what our figures are, you know, and the amount of people that share our stories, comment on our stories, the impact that we're making, and the kind of people that write for us, you know. As far as I'm concerned, you know, anyone in the Muslim community can write for us. As long as the articles are well sourced, that they're not crazy, you know, conspiracy theory type articles or whatever, and as long as they're professionally produced. I mean, we do have red lines, obviously. We're not going to...
So tell me what those red lines
are. Yeah, well, we're not going to promote anybody that promotes Prevent, for example. I think Prevent is a red line. So obviously, our community is being spied upon, monitored, harassed, like no other minority community in the UK, apart from the Irish, perhaps, has ever been monitored. And those Muslims in our community that are down with that, are down with the Prevent strategy, are our open enemies, as far as they are fair game. Okay, they will be named and shamed.
Yeah.
Okay, because they have shown their true colours in the sense that they are siding with a counter-terrorism policy that oppresses their brothers and sisters. Mm. Now, 10 years ago when Prevent just came out, maybe you could say I'm naive, a bit naive then, I was trying to help the community, trying to stop terrorism, trying to stop extremism. I can understand that. 10 years into the Prevent counter-terrorism strategy, we know exactly what this is about. Mm. You know, and if you're still down with it, you have got a major problem.
So Prevent is a red line. What other red lines do we have?
Well, we're not going to have any Zionists on there, you know, saying Israel is a wonderful state and how well they treat the Palestinians and how they're all terrorists. We're not going to, you know, I think...
Mainstream red lines? Do you consider them to be mainstream red lines?
No, the mainstream, I mean the Zionists, they don't need their own media because they've got the BBC, right?
We're talking about intra-Muslim mainstream. Do you think anti-Prevent, anti-Zionism is mainstream red lines within the Muslim community?
I think anti-Prevent is becoming that. I think some channels and outlets have been... They need to have been coaxed to take that position. But I think Prevent is a battle that we can win because it's not something that is just mainstream in the Muslim community, but even non-Muslims, you know, that are obliged to spy in schools and hospitals and universities, they don't want to do that. You know, the average non-Muslim in this country, they don't want to spy on their Muslim, you know, co-citizens, you know.
Okay. But, without slating me or praising me too much, have you found
working with me? Oh, we're talking about you now. Yeah, I thought we were talking about me. No.
well, you can choose to say no comment. It ain't a police interview, but have you found working with me for 4 years?
Well, there's a section on you, isn't there? Yeah. To your delight, there's a section on you in the book. Yeah. Look, I think, alhamdulillah, we've worked well together. I think we're different people, you know, and we come from different backgrounds and different political viewpoints in many ways, even religious viewpoints to a certain extent. Mm. And I think that's a wonderful example of how British Muslims can work to each other. I think we're setting the example. Mm. You know, some people don't believe with your views on Syria and my views on Syria, how do these two guys work with each other? But we do. Mm. You know, I think on domestic issues, we're basically in tune. You know, 90% of the time, we agree on domestic issues pertaining to Muslims. Yeah. On foreign policy, I think, to be honest, I think maybe we're in tune maybe on 50%, yeah. and 50% we're not. And on some of the biggest issues of the day, like Syria, we're not in tune. And that could have destroyed other relationships, and it hasn't destroyed our relationship. I can't, you know, let's be honest, we have had our rocky times.
We have indeed.
Alhamdulillah, we haven't made that too public, but we have had very frank discussions. And sometimes, you know, we've been on the verge of, you know, not completely falling out, but we have had our tough times. But I think we've gone through that. Yeah. And I think personally, we're friends.
Absolutely.
You know, not. I mean, I'm not the kind of person that has lots of friends.
Yeah.
You know that. I'm not like a party person.
Okay.
But you know, I think we are personal friends, and professionally, we work well together. And I think we are grown enough and mature enough to put our differences to the side, to a certain extent.
Okay. Fair enough.
Would you agree with that? Before?
Yeah. No. I agree. I agree that Syria has definitely been a point of contention and disagreement for us, and we have had some very frank discussions, and we've been tested.
Yeah.
But again, for 4 years, we've worked very well. Without making this interview about me, when it came to journalism, you were my mentor.
Yeah.
The way I write and the way I present myself was a lot down to your good self, Yvonne Ridley and others who trained me when I was a young trainee coming up. Yeah, I think
this is turning into a bit of a love in now. Hay and Bellew after that fight yesterday.
Yeah, yeah, I'm not too much into bromance, but yeah, I mean, 4 years on, we're still going strong, and I hope that it continues, inshallah.
Yeah.
In terms of demographics, what kind of demographics were you trying to reach out to with this book? Was it Muslims, non-Muslims, budding journalists? Who was it?
I think two set kind of groups of people are going to be interested in this. I think British Muslims generally. Are going to be interested in this book. Anyone that's interested in British Muslim issues. And I will say this is perhaps one of the only books by a British Muslim that's written in a readable way, also talks about the British Muslim experience from a non-establishment point of view. And I think most Muslims are anti-establishment in this country to one extent or another. So any British Muslim is going to be interested in this book. But also Muslims that aren't from Britain will be interested, because I talk a lot about my travels to Iraq, to Lebanon, to Libya, to Egypt, to Gaza, all these war zones and places that I've been to around the world, is a big part of the book. You know? So I think Muslims generally...
The Arab Spring.
Yeah, the Arab Spring. So I think there's a whole section on the Arab Spring. Anyone that's interested in global Muslim issues will also be interested in this book. And I think those who are interested in the way the media works, and the media is part of our lives, whether we're journalists or not, will be very interested in this book, because I talk about Al Jazeera, one of the biggest, kind of Arab institutions there is, one of the biggest brands in the world. I worked at Al Jazeera for a few years, and I talk about what it's like to work at Al Jazeera. I talk about Islam Channel, one of our biggest British Muslim institutions. Yes, of course. And the first British Muslim TV channel. I talk about Press TV, you know, which has been around for about 10 years now, and is people will know about Press TV, an Iranian channel. I talk about the British mainstream media. I've done shows for the BBC. I've done shows for ITV, for Channel 4. So I think I've got a wide spectrum of interest in terms of I've worked for Saudi media, Saudi-funded media, Iranian-funded media, Qatari-funded media. I've worked for British mainstream media. So I think anyone who's really interested in the way the media works will be interested in this. And I tell the truth as far as I see it as well. I don't BS. I say what good things journalists do and what bad things they do, what values they hold, what values they don't hold, how they can be grossly hypocritical, but how they can be benevolent and kind, etc. So, those two groups are my kind of focus. But I also think non-Muslims as well, we don't want to be living in a bubble here. I think non-Muslims, we are their co-citizens, not subjects, citizens. Yeah. And they'll, 3 million Muslims in the UK now, 1.6 billion Muslims in the world. Surely they will be interested in these issues I talk about as well.
And before we end this interview, can you please tell the viewers where we can actually buy this book?
Yes, so there's three platforms. So you can buy it on paperback. There is an Amazon link, which we will be publicising, and you can buy it on paperback through that Amazon link. You can buy it through your Kindle if you own an Amazon Kindle. I know many people do. All you do is look in the Kindle store, Confessions of a Muslim Journalist, or type my name in, Roshan Muhammad Salih, and you'll find it straight away. You can download it straight away to your Kindle. If you don't have a Kindle, everyone's got a tablet these days or a mobile phone. Yeah. All you do is download the Kindle app and you can read it on your tablet or your mobile phone through the Kindle app, and all you do again is search through the Kindle store.
Okay. Roshan, Jazakallah khair again for your time.
Jazakallah.
And I wish you all the best with your new book.
Thank you. Inshallah.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was all for this episode of Pressing Questions. Please do share this video with friends and contacts on social media. And until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.